Kia ora, greetings and welcome to Green Planet FM. I'm Tim Lynch and I trust that you are doing well. I invite you to stay with me over the next hour as we discuss and find ways to take care of our unique and magnificent green planet Earth. Climate Change and Governance Conference. Last week, we had a large conference in Wellington. It took place at a time of mounting international concern over the speed and magnitude of global climate change and its likely economic, social, and environmental impact. There's now little doubt that climate change represents one of the greatest and most urgent challenges faced by the world community. The conference explored the nature and likely impacts of climate change and the options for accelerated action by governments, business, and the wider community. This conference was particularly timely given the current state of intergovernmental discussions on policies to mitigate climate change and our New Zealand government's current review of climate change policies. On the telephone, I have Professor Peter Barrett, who in 2004 won the Marsden Medal as one of our best scientists. Peter has spent a lot of time, 26 years in fact, on the Antarctic continent, and so thank you for coming on to the show, Peter.
Yeah, thank you, Tim.
Peter, I realise that a lot of the information is still being collated regarding this conference. Can you give me a sort of a personal overview of how you felt it went and possibly your outlook as to where it's going?
Okay, well, perhaps just to begin, I should say that this is a rather unusual conference in that it began with the science. We had a day of presenting many people from around the world presenting the latest information on the science of climate change, both how it's working and where it's going. And the second day was one in which people with policy experience shared this and looked for ways in which, having established that in fact climate change is a serious problem, this is widely agreed, what was the best way of dealing with it, and a rather complex social organisation that we share with others around the world.
Yes. So what I would like you to do, Peter, is possibly just give the listeners an idea. You did one of the opening addresses, of course. You talked about your particular research into Antarctica, and you sort of helped set the stage of what the problems were, where the major changes were happening, and in the polar ice cap regions, of course, receding glaciers, and of course others came on later on to talk about their particular fields. Can you tell us how you led into this conference?
Sure. Yeah, my job was to provide a context for what's happening at the moment. And by what's happening, I mean the measurements that show that carbon dioxide levels are rising rapidly. The temperature is also rising, not quite so rapidly. But when we look back into the distant past, you have to go back over 20 million years to find CO2 levels as high as we're now approaching. And even through the ice ages, and we know the ice age record very well because it comes from the ice cores, and we have a detailed tracking of temperature and atmospheric gases over the last million years, that these cycles have operated within quite a narrow range, 10 to 15 degrees Celsius, and we're currently at the upper limit of that range. But projections are, as CO2 levels rise, and they're way out of that range already, the temperature will follow and take us 3 or 4 degrees higher just by the end of the century. So this, in geological terms, is astonishingly fast. Now, maybe at this stage it should be mentioned that it's now quite clear from several angles that this rise in CO2 is a consequence of the burning of fossil fuels, which have, coal and oil have been sequestered for hundreds of millions of years, and we're in the process of burning up the supply in a few centuries. So we're burning fossil fuels off thousands of times faster than they're actually accumulating. And so this is not a state of balance. But we also know that this is the cause of CO2 rise is fossil fuels, not just from the sums, because you can calculate how many gigatons of carbon are being burnt up. Turns out to be, we're actually burning up twice as much as is actually left in the rising levels of the atmosphere. Somewhere on Earth, we think it's split between the oceans and the vegetation. The rest is being soaked up. But this is even recorded by the isotopes of carbon that are changing the atmosphere to respond to the burning of fossil fuel. So the case for the CO2 rise caused by fossil fuels and temperature following it is really now undeniable in mainstream science.
Yes, because New Zealand, basically, we're the 55th biggest emitter of greenhouse gases, and even though it only accounts for just 0.2% of the global total greenhouse gas, we're 11th in the world for emissions per head. So we're putting out 19, was it, tons per person, against an average of 5.6 tons per person in the world. And so we in New Zealand, in many cases, are our ecological footprint is so big for such a small country, and yet we don't seem to be able to get government to come on board. It was the carbon tax, which the government recently walked away from, was a great pity because they didn't converse with the public. They didn't sell it at all. They just rammed it on us, so to speak, and then decided it was too hard. Do you think that we needed time for consultation? There needed to be a lot more communication on many levels to get people on side, to let them actually understand what the problem is, because very few people still today don't really understand what's going on.
But Tim, I think that's the core of it. I suspect most New Zealanders still don't see climate change as a threat, certainly not an immediate threat. And it's a tricky one because not many people are in a position to sit back and think about this and to read and to actually understand just what a dangerous business it is. I mean, it's like a cancer that, in fact, the symptoms are very subtle initially, and it's really not until the disease is well advanced is it going to become obvious.
Yes, because it's interesting. I have heard if we don't move now and deal with science, in years to come, it'll be a huge moral problem or a values problem because we didn't act. And so there has to be basically an integration of the moral ideals as well as just straight science to, shall we say, use the precautionary principles and get on and starting to map out and then action a way to get through this.
Yeah, well, I think Minister Hodgson made a feature of this when he spoke at the start of the conference, talking about our obligation as a good global citizen, and especially with our relatively strong ecological footprint that you describe. But he also explained that, or he put the government's position, which was that they did not believe they could have the numbers to pass the legislation necessary for the carbon tax. Now, many people could well argue with that, but there is a sort of a reality that most New Zealanders, I think, aren't actually convinced. And for those of us who have been studying it, this is a matter of some concern, and really there's a big job out there to convince people that this is going to happen, I think, rather sooner than has been projected. That's my worry anyway.
I agree. A lot of people who are intuitive, who go hiking in the outback, they know, they can actually feel that there's something going on.
Maybe if I can just cut in there for a moment and say you don't have to be all that intuitive. There's an economist of some note who, and I quote, says, "Now global warming is real and it's caused by CO2. And this is Bjorn Lomborg, who wrote The Skeptical Environmentalist, and this is an article in the Dominion Post last Thursday.
He's come around, has he?
Well, it does seem like it, but that's his statement. I just quoted, "Now global warming is real and caused by CO2. Now, he goes on to say, "The trouble is that climate models show," and it's interesting that he takes note of climate models, he doesn't just dismiss them, "that immediate action will do very little good." And he just leaves it there. He says, because of that, then let's do something else. But what he doesn't say is that the models indicate that if action isn't taken now, it will be much harder later on. And so it's this notion of a legacy that we're leaving if we take no action now.
Yeah, Lord Oxborough, when he gave his speech, he said that urgency, time is running out. And this, I think, frustrates a lot of people because we just don't know what to do. Yet Sweden has already got together business and the government and the community and said, right, 2020, we're going to phase out all fossil fuels. Have we got dialogue going on with the universities and the governments within, or the departments within the Swedish government?
Well, I suspect we will have soon, because even since the conference, emails have been going around about a goal for New Zealand being along the lines of the Swedish model. So one of the things that the conference has done is to not just alert people to the seriousness and the urgency of the situation, but there's a lot of focus now on what needs to be done to reassure people, if you like, that there are things that they can do at many levels, personally, at local government level, nationally.
Yes, there has been one or two interesting pieces put in the... I looked www.stuff and did a search on climate change, and there's some interesting statements there. They're looking at, of course, is that we have to start taxing the heavy gas-guzzling cars in particular as just one start. But I'm sure that they would have come up with a few more novel ideas. I mean, you know, the methane tax that they're going to put on farmers some years ago, there was a good number of people who thought that the fart tax had merit. And again, the government didn't sell it and they just dumped it on the farmers. And, of course, they reacted. Because methane, of course, is 20 times more potent than CO2. Can you run off a couple of ideas, Peter, that possibly we could at least debate or discuss?
Oh, look, I think there's hope in that area, and I think it was it wasn't sold particularly well. I mean, I grew up on a farm myself, so I've got some sympathy with the farmers being somewhat dumped on. It seemed to me that it was a tax that should be more broadly spread, because we all benefit from what comes off farms, not just the farmers. But never mind that. I think it's also important to move on and this has happened in some areas. One of the papers at the conference was from AgriSearch on the work they are doing to selectively breed low methane producing ruminants, so that and this can be done just by conventional breeding methods. There's quite a range, it turns out, in the amount of methane produced by different animals. And looking at the sort of feed that actually reduces methane emissions, just some practical stuff. And this is being funded for only $4 million a year. This is quite a small sum, but the guys are really dedicated, and I think they're doing a great job. But that's just one of a number of focuses. So I think there's no single answer that's going to fix this. We need to think about living, getting used to low-energy lifestyles in a broad sense.
Yes, I think this was spoken to by a lot of people when they went and saw Lord Oxborough, the ex-chairman of Shell. He didn't mention anything about curtailing growth as such. And I realise that as consumers, and all we have to do is look at how much waste we throw out of a household every week to see that we're chewing through a lot of the a lot of, should we say, product from the land, or etc. So do you think we might have to have a Kyoto Mark II relatively soon to start consolidating on Kyoto One?
I think this is bound to come about, and simply because there's so much effort went in not just to develop the Kyoto Protocol, but the whole United Nations Framework Convention that has monitoring emissions from countries around the world. I mean, that's a huge achievement. You really need to know just where the emissions are coming from, what sectors of the economy, so that you can make sensible decisions about how to address them, so that you can do this in an economically efficient fashion. And so it's, to me, the success of Kyoto has been at least in part being able to measure what's going on, and that's a great achievement. So that's why I think that whatever happens, we should support the Kyoto process. Now, once that's done, then there are issues about how to encourage, or perhaps let countries set targets that then become legally enforceable so that business can plan, because that's another issue that came out of the conference, the importance for business to function of actually knowing what the rules are. And traditionally it's been for governments to set the rules and then business works within them. But of course business, governments and society actually has an interest in all of this working without causing us to drown in our own pollution. So I guess what I'm moving towards or suggesting is, in the broader sense, it's in everybody's interest to pay attention and be part of this sort of discussion or conversation that did not stop, has not stopped with this conference. This conference is spawning other meetings at various levels in which individuals and groups, and I suspect, well, ultimately government, our government, will be developing policy to make progress on this huge issue.
So the New Zealand Business Group, how did they react? Because up until now, they've been very, very sceptical and have tended to play the very cautious note on this and follow sort of a National Party line. Have they now realised that they just can't sort of hide behind political posturing and realise that they have to participate and set a good example at the same time?
Well, I'm really not in a position to say, but just from my observation as a layperson and what I read in the papers, it seems to me that you can't really characterise business with any single position. There's a whole spectrum of views through the business world. And at the international level, you've got companies like BP who are marketing themselves as energy companies, not oil companies, and with a strong conservation motif. At regional and local levels, there are many companies also taking advantage, if you like, of that. And in my own experience, I was checking out hybrids, and there is a company in New Zealand that actually makes a point of, you know, providing us with information about hybrids, cars that we can purchase because of their super efficiency. So, I mean, and of course, there's New Zealand companies making windmills. So, though I guess you'd have to say that business, as represented by some groups prominently in the press, has been saying that really there isn't a problem. But I think it's really hard to sustain that now. And I'm sure that very soon we'll see an acknowledgement of that. And I would like to think across all sectors of government as well, because the scientific evidence is really just increasingly hard to dispute.
Because when I watch television, I'll be watching TV possibly tonight for a few moments, I'll watch all the advertisements, and of course you won't notice one thing. And this is one of the interesting things about business, of course, that they want to be optimistic. They want to be able to be buoyant and tell people that's all right, because at heart we want to feel secure in the world. And, of course, they're also pushing a storyline, for want of a better word, that you don't have to worry about anything, just buy these products and enjoy yourself, and that's it.
Well, if they are ultimately successful and persuade people of that, then we will end up in a state of paralysis for a whole bunch of reasons. And I guess the only question is whether it'll be 10, 20 or 30 or 40 years. But ultimately, as the ice continues to melt, as rains get heavier, as droughts get longer, as storm surges get bigger, there'll be this just huge destructive sort of cost on national economies and ultimately the global economy. So that line of thinking that we can simply continue to sort of expand our economy and take no notice of the consequences, I think is rather short-sighted. I mean, we wouldn't be the first civilization, in fact, to go down this way. And it simply reminds me of a wonderful little book that I'd like to recommend to your listeners by Ronald Wright called A Short History of Progress. And Wright sort of talks about a progress trap when sort of societies get so good at something that they expand their populations, you know, whether this is irrigation or, you know, really taking every advantage of the natural world. But there comes a point where this can't be sustained. The classic case of this is the Easter Islanders.
Gerard Diamond, is it?
Well, Gerard Diamond also, very similar theme, but Wright says it in 130 pages, and Gerard Diamond takes longer, but it's really the same story. So right at the moment, we're sustained by oil and globally, and that's going to come to an end. And not only is it going to come to an end, but the byproducts, the CO2, are actually destabilizing, if you like, our climate, or making it more extreme. And there are we saw graphs at the conference to show this, that there's no question for most people that Hurricane Katrina was much more powerful than it would have been if the waters of the Gulf had not been 2 degrees warmer. So $200 billion is quite a heavy price to pay for a hurricane. But these sorts of events will become more common. And that's what's in store for us over the next few decades if we don't address the rising CO2 issue.
With Pete Hodgson leading, did you have any other New Zealand government officials moving through? Are they sort of excited about wanting to do it, or are they reluctant? How much passion have they got for this, Peter?
Well, I think at the working level, the officials are actually, they are quite passionate and concerned. And I think in New Zealand at the moment, the parties are pretty evenly balanced. And so there's, that's really having, well, I don't want to use the word paralysing, but that's the word that comes to mind. But it's also an opportunity, and one of the refreshing voices at the conference was Simon Upton, who has been in Paris heading up the OECD Commission for Sustainable Development, and he was very direct in his view, which is that this is because of this sort of, if you like, hiatus in policy. Apart from, of course, the Greens, who actually announced a very coherent set of plans, but with the lack of policy from the two major parties, this was an ideal time to look for a cross-party agreement, take advantage of the opportunity. He also took the view that some form of carbon tax was a very simple and sensible way of starting, to start at a low level and tune it to favour sort of low-carbon energy sources and penalise high-carbon ones. It's very simple and straightforward, but it would be nice to make a start, I think, is what he was advocating.
Well, he was the Minister for the Environment for the National Party, wasn't he? And, of course, when you are a Minister for the Environment, you really get in touch with it. And like even Geoffrey Palmer, when he became Minister of Environment, he really got involved as well. And it's good to know that politicians who look at their portfolios and take it to the nth degree. So, I mean, I was pleasantly surprised to see Simon Upton speaking about this too, because evidently the government calculated that the overall cost for a carbon tax would be about $4 a week per household. Have you heard anything like that?
That's $200 a year is that about $1 billion a year?
I don't know if it gets quite to that much. I'm not sure, but this was, I got this out of a Sunday Star Times, and this was by this is in the editorial, they mentioned something like that, yes. And, we'll just have to keep on pushing for that. And Peter, how is your optimism as a result of, you've seen how a group of people can come to New Zealand, bearing in mind that America and Australia are still outside the camp. Do you feel that in the end that the Australians and the Americans will come, particularly if there's a change in the midterm government elections in America?
Oh, look, I think most Americans are already there. I'd simply encourage your listeners to pick up Time magazine, this week's Time magazine. And the front cover has a lonely polar bear. And the heading is, Be Worried, Be Very Worried. And there is a very plain-spoken set of articles on the realities of climate change, how it's changing. It's rather well explained. There's even a poll that indicates that most Americans actually believe it's happening and they think that the government should do something about it.
Yes, I realise many states are moving forward, particularly on the West Coast. Peter, can I just move over? When you went to America a year ago, you talked on radio right across the states. Did you then also get a lot of interest in what you were doing, particularly from somebody who'd come from the Southern Hemisphere, a small country like New Zealand? It's like the mouse that roared.
Well, not a great deal of interest, but I'm just one of many scientists who are sort of prepared to publicly sort of express concern. Probably the best known is Jim Hansen, who's at the Goddard Space Center. He's a senior scientist there who last December said we've got 10 years left to make a change. And by that, he wasn't meaning we can wait for another 10 years. He means we need to start now and actually have our emissions under control in 10 years' time. But he has complained about being muzzled by people from the Bush administration. And there's another whole story there. But at least this is being reported, and I think those concerns, they're being expressed, and the scientists are now being heard. So we've got past the point where senior officials, non-science officials, were actually changing. They were actually changing the deleting or adding qualifications to statements made by scientists. And now the scientists are saying, no, we deserve the right to say what we're saying without you changing them. So that's an advance.
I heard that an Australian scientist also, the CSIRO, had the same problems. So, yes, well, I'm glad to know that at least we in New Zealand have got scientists who can freely speak, Peter.
I'm sure that's so. Well, it is happening. It just reminds me that there are still some scientists who don't accept that global warming is happening. And, of course, they're also speaking out. But I'd say to the public, this is not a complex issue. Just look at the graphs, look at the pictures that are presented, particularly the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, that this global authority, which works only with published data. So the weight that carries for me as a scientist, because they work only with published data, makes their data just that much more reliable. And their position is that CO2 is rising, temperature is rising. And they see this as a major threat. It's really just then up to, of course, governments and citizens to respond to it.
How many of the public who came to Te Papa, was there a good audience to listen to the scientists presenting?
Well, yes, the conference was oversubscribed. We had spaces for 350, I think, in total. And we had an overflow of about 50 or 60 in another room. But also there was a fee. And on the last night of the conference, our students organised a film session in a Café Scientifique down at the Paramount Cinema. And that was packed. That was sold out. And there were 500, mostly young people in there, and partly question and answer and partly film. So there was just a lot of interest. And in fact, my colleague David King from British Antarctic Survey, who was here, said he was simply amazed at the interest shown, especially by young people, he said, in his hometown of Cambridge in the UK. He was sure that they wouldn't get a turnout like that.
Is this the same David King who works with the British government as the advisor on climate change?
Golly, did I say David King? Yes. I meant David Vaughan.
Okay. Yeah.
David Vaughan works for British Antarctic Survey. You're right. David King is a senior government advisor. It's a different person. Though he has the same view on climate change, in fact, was probably the first senior sort of international scientists to speak out publicly on the threat that it posed 2 or 3 years ago.
Yes, he definitely was a leader for us. What I also would like to know is that when Tony Blair came on the screen, because what he said, the some people call it rhetoric, but he said specifically that we must, that the constituents, the electorate, the public, the community must force virtually the governments to change. And how was the How did it feel when he came across?
Well, I think it felt to me as here was a familiar face saying something that I'd heard him say before. I think with rather more force when he was first saying it, and I think he deserves enormous credit for making climate change one of the two big issues for the G8 meeting last July. And more than that, the work that he did to get together the group that looked at the question of what is dangerous climate change. And there was a meeting in Exeter a little over a year ago that considered that. And at that meeting, they concluded that if CO2 levels rose up to above 400 parts per million, that would imply a temperature rise of 2 degrees Celsius, and that was really the danger level. So just to pursue that line a little bit further, since then, because CO2 is now rising faster than before, there was a comments at the conference, including from Lord Oxborough, that 400 parts per million was a bit unrealistic, and we really needed to be thinking as to what we do when it gets up to 500 parts per million, and we really need to try and turn things out by then. So this is just in the space of a year. But getting back to Tony Blair's comments, yes, it was good to see him up there and saying that. He'd said it before. But I guess from where I sat, having said that in a convincing way, I don't think he had a clear view as to actually how to deal with the problem beyond saying the people really have to take this on board as politicians. They have to give us the signal.
Yes. Yeah, he's a cheerleader in many ways, or a recent one. But I think it's a huge problem now for people to get the grips of it, because we need, as you say, the scientists and the business people and local governments and everybody who produces goods, etc., and food. I can see why they're taking a long time to get to it, to find some sort of model in which we can start to action.
Well, just from a personal point of view, I'm actually not willing to wait for business or anybody else to act on this. I mean, in my personal life, I'm moving to a low-energy lifestyle because that's how it's going to be, and I want to get used to it. And that doesn't mean I'm not going to want to listen to my CD player or radio or television or use the internet, but there are low-energy ways of doing this. And there are ways in which we can do it that make us independent of national supply. So my goal is a home that requires very little energy to heat, has its own water, and really has just low external energy requirements. And I think if we all did that, whatever happened, we would actually be all better off.
Healthier too. Because solar hot water, this could be put on every roof in the country, and this is where it would be good to get all the political parties to say, yes, we're going to do this. We're going to start giving rebates to any business that produces a product that's sustainable, that's low energy using, etc. It just seems to be that nobody wants to lead here. Of course, the Greens have just recently put out...
Yeah, I was going to say, the Greens actually have that as policy. Yeah. And I thought that was one of the policies that Labor actually sort of signed up to in their agreement with the Greens, that they would actually support, I don't know if you want to call it subsidy, but sort of financial help for getting a wider number of solar water heaters installed nationally. And I don't even, well, I'm no economist, but just off the top of my head, I'm not sure that it needs a subsidy so much as what you might call bridging finance. In other words, because the payoff time is so long, it really makes people reluctant to make that big investment, and you can understand that certainly in young people who have been to university with huge student loans. So if funding could be made available so that that could be paid off over the lifetime of the asset, then that would, I think, make a big difference to people being willing to commit to that sort of energy saving.
I think we'd have to work out a system, because if hot water's around about 30 to 35% of your total bill, and every house had solar hot water, like they do in Israel, of course it's a lot hotter, but 30 years ago, every apartment building and house in Israel had solar hot water. And if you go to China, you'll find that every apartment has got solar hot water too. So if the New Zealand government could do a deal with out of China, but preferably if it could make it here, it would be jobs for New Zealanders, and just say, right, well, this is going, we'll offset that against putting up a new power station or ramming a dam in where dams are not really needed. I'm sure that you could find a creative way to work this out.
Well, I would think so too, Tim.
Yes.
But I think there's now more incentive than there was last year, and my suspicion there'll be even more incentive in a couple of years' time when the, as the monitoring of the planet continues to update us on the state of the climate.
Peter, we've got just a few more moments, and I'd like you to tell us what you actually do. You've been on the ice 26 years in Antarctica?
Not all of that time, Tim. I thought when you said that at the start, that's a tall ask. I might have been 26 times to Antarctica,
okay.
But that's not 26 years. Most of my time is spent in New Zealand. But, yes, what I do here at Wellington is I lead an Antarctic research group with a particular interest in finding out about past climate. We do this in two areas. One is in the distant past. We've had a series of drilling projects which actually allow us to say that the coast of Antarctica was covered with beech forest 30 million years ago. And we know this from the cores that we've taken off the seafloor of that age. And that, but then Antarctica got cold and the big ice sheet became permanent about 15 million years ago, and so it's been cold ever since. But now we're interested in the way in which climate behaves more subtly and perhaps looking for the warning signs. And you probably know that ice shelves have been breaking up around the Antarctic Peninsula. And we've got a big project looking at the history of the Ross Ice Shelf. It's called Andril, and it's 50% American, 25% Kiwi, and the rest with Italian and German participation. But the goal of that project is to core the seafloor under the Ross Ice Shelf and find out how it has fluctuated over the last couple of million years. Because we know that ice sheets fluctuate, like the big ice sheets of the Northern Hemisphere have been fluctuating just due to natural causes. So we want to know, when did the ice sheet last break out? What were the temperature conditions when it last broke out? Because then we can have other colleagues who actually do the computer models, and they can tune their computer models for this ice shelf behavior. And one of the big turning points in Antarctica's history in the future, probably near future if we don't do something about it, is this huge breakout of 500,000 square kilometres of permanent ice, which I hope won't happen, but that's the threat if CO2 levels continue to rise. And we really want some knowledge of how hard we have to work to stop that happening.
So that's is it the West Antarctic Ice Shelf too? Is that part of this?
Well, there is a West Antarctic Ice Sheet, which is the small one. That has only 6 metres of sea level rise in it. The big ice sheet is the East Antarctic Ice Sheet. That has 60 metres of sea level rise. At the moment, West Antarctica is actually melting a bit faster than expected. And it started to actually contribute to sea level rise, but only 0.5 millimetre a year. And that isn't a worry, but if it speeds up, it will be a worry. But this big area of floating permanent ice is sitting between the two. And that will break up, we're pretty sure, if temperature rises in that area by 5 degrees Celsius. Now, that's actually quite a bit. But the Antarctic Peninsula has already warmed 2.5 degrees Celsius in the last 50 years. And if the oceans warm around Antarctica, and they've begun to do this already, but if they warm much more, they will actually hasten the departure of this huge sheet of floating ice.
Do they have any rivers in summer, or is it just little trickles? I've heard that in Greenland, in height of midsummer or just a little bit after, that rivers actually start to form from melted ice, and I haven't heard the full story, but some of these rivers are supposed to be quite big.
Yes, they are in Greenland, and one of the discoveries has been in the last year or two that these in southern Greenland have reached the point where they actually run down to the bottom of the glacier and they lubricate it and make it go even faster. In Antarctica, at least in the Ross Sea region, yes, there are, well, streams, not rivers, but streams on the surfaces of some of the big outlet glaciers, like the Taylor and the Mackay. But they run for about a month. And even in the dry valleys, there's a river that just runs for a short period. Around the peninsula, though, I guess the landscape is, well, it's a little bit different. But I know on the surface of the ice shelves there, the ones that have just broken up recently, like the Larsen, that was very wet. There were huge pools and sort of rivers running down on the surface of the ice shelves. And that really precipitated their breakup. And this was a couple of years ago.
Because I also have heard that there has been some small grass, lichen-type grass, growing in Antarctica.
Well, again, this is that tip of the Antarctic called the Antarctic Peninsula. It's where most of the tourist ships go. And this is an area of Antarctica that's much warmer. The rest of Antarctica hasn't warmed, but that's at least in part because the ozone, because we destroyed the ozone hole. And so by destroying ozone, which is a greenhouse gas, we actually had a sort of artificial cooling. So when that reforms, we'll lose the threat of cancer, but we'll get some enhanced warming.
Yes, it is a complex situation, isn't it? So many variables all coming together to affect something that starts the ball rolling.
Well, it is. And look, there's one more thing that actually doesn't relate to climate, but another effect that no one would have thought of, at least until 3 or 4 years ago, and that is the acidification of the oceans, that as CO2 levels rise, the oceans become more acidic. And it's measurable, and it's now the effects can be seen on shelly organisms like reef corals and...
More brittle, are they?
They're more, yes, or but I'm thinking about 90% of the plant, marine plants, algae in the oceans have calcareous sort of shells, tiny shells, and they have been sucking huge amounts of CO2 out of the atmosphere, then they settle to the sea floor and they keep the carbon balance maintained. But they're actually becoming less effective because of the higher CO2 levels in the surface waters of the ocean. So we're having this profound effect on just one of the sort of the basic or the lowest levels of the food chain. And who can tell what consequences that's going to have, except that they're bound not to be particularly good ones.
Yes, I have an understanding that the permafrost across Siberia, Russia, Alaska and Canada are also causing huge problems too, Peter. It just goes on. However, I guess we just have to be as optimistic as possible.
Well, yeah, but I think we need to actually figure out what to do about it, and we do what we can in our personal life, and we then make sure that, well, we read and we inform ourselves, and we are willing to write to politicians, see our members of parliament, and because I think that's really how things are going to change. And at the same time, I think we're actually giving ourselves a survival advantage in the future, because we'll be preparing ourselves and our communities.
Cooperating with the community to form delegations to go and see our MPs on a weekly basis to really push the point, I guess.
Yes, every opportunity.
Yes.
When you see them in the street, just ask what they're doing about it.
Excellent. Peter, thank you very much for sharing of your expertise and your goodwill. I'm hoping to get a group of people who will be able to tell us what sort of solutions we can have, so the program will be devoted totally to things to do in your community to get us mobilised and activated.
Yeah, people should check the Ministry for the Environment's website on climate change too, because there's a lot of good practical advice there. If you just type in climate change into Google, and it used to be www.4million.org.
Yes.
But that might have been shifted or upgraded, but it will be within the Ministry for the Environment's website.
Excellent. Very good, Peter.
Oh, well, thank you, Tim. Thanks for the chance to chat.
Okay, and we'll keep in touch.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Righto, bye-bye.
That was New Zealand's top scientists from 2004, Professor Peter Barrett of Wellington, talking about climate change and the recent conference in Wellington. Plus, our need as a humanity to quickly embrace a wider and deeper understanding of how we as a race can survive on our planet. Meanwhile, I want you to stay with me, as shortly I'll be offering a chance of a free stay in luxury in surroundings overlooking the glorious Parkeri Beach. But first, please get a pen and paper. Here on our Green Planet program, the aim is to communicate and talk about environmental solutions to the overwhelming challenges that surround us and those unseen over the horizon. Subjects that we here in New Zealand seem to be unwilling to discuss in the public arena, and often not openly debated within our democratic society here. So by talking, thinking and brainstorming solutions with your friends and family, we can support the kids of today and tomorrow, as well as the ideal of a sustainable future. And if you want to contact me by email, tim@ourplanet.org. Remember this, tim@ourplanet.org. But better still, phone the station here, 302-0238, 302-0238, and let the station manager know that you are listening. This way you support what we are doing. Now, I would like those who have web access to write down www.terradelmar, T-E-R-A-D-E-L-M-A-R, terradelmar.co.nz. This leads you to a luxury bed and breakfast overlooking the beautiful Parkeri Beach up north. And what's being offered is a Saturday night stay in a luxury, large, appointed double bedroom for you and your partner, and a sumptuous breakfast on Sunday morning. To enable you to be in the draw for this night of royal splendour, is that I'm asking you for one strategic action, only one, that we as a nation can instigate to slow down global warming and climate change. And the 10 best or novel ideas I'll read out to our listening audience, and these will be put into a hat and drawn by the office manager and announced over the year. This will happen on Thursday the 13th of April, so you have to send your entries in by that date to tim@ourplanet.org, or post to me, Tim, Planet FM, Box 5609, Auckland. 5609, Auckland. wishing you a wonderful week. I look forward to being with you again next week at Green Planet FM 104.6, same time, 8 till 9 a.m. next Thursday. And if you want to tune in to www.greenplanetfm.com, you can see who's been interviewed and also read the blog. I'm doing blogs to keep you informed of what's happening for our green planet here, 104.6. Bye-bye.